Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm looking forward to this week's episode. We've got some great guests recently. Sam has lined up for us, and of course, this week is no exception. But of course, that means we need to bring Sam in here. So, hey, Sam, you've been doing overtime getting some great people lined up.
Well, you know, I don't know why I didn't think about my public safety writers group before, because they're amazing. And there's so many interesting people from, you know, retired cops and detectives and FBI guys and just all sorts of stuff. And we'll talk to another one of them tonight. So I'm tired of 100 plus degree heat, Dan DePodwin. Dan is with us as our weather expert, and we have not a new person, but a new title for Miss Becky. She is now our emergency planning and preparedness weather expert. Take a bow, Miss Becky.
I like that. I appreciate the pivot here. You know, not working for a weather company anymore and not doing operational meteorology in a while, unfortunately takes its toll, and I'm not in touch anymore. But Dan is, so that's good.
Well, Jamie came up with that title, and I think it's pretty awesome because,
yeah,
you know, once you get this under your belt for a bit, we'll see what you're actually doing out there in emergency preparedness land.
Yes.
So, Dan, I hear there's some kind of hurricane warnings going on out there.
Yeah, the tropics in June usually are on the quieter side, but we've already had two named storms, Anna and Bill, and we are likely to get our third named storm of the year, probably by the time we head through Friday, which would be Claudette in the Gulf of Mexico. Going to be a fairly quick moving storm as it moves from the southern Gulf towards the Louisiana coast. And the main threat from this is heavy flooding rainfall. And in a lot of areas from Louisiana through Alabama, they've had a lot of flooding rainfall already this spring and into the, well, I guess we're not technically in summer yet, but the spring has been quite wet. So any additional rainfall is not a good thing. So while it will be a fairly quick moving system, we can see and probably 8 to 12 inches of rain in some of the hardest hit areas. It looks likely in eastern Louisiana through southern Mississippi and southern Alabama where they'll get that heavy rainfall. And that's where we can expect some flooding problems. Not a lot of wind with the system or storm surge, which is good, but still not a great scenario for places that are already waterlogged over the last several months.
Yeah, it's too bad we can't ship some of that to California so they could put out their fires.
No, absolutely. With the fires in California and the heat wave across much of the West, here in the East, it's actually been quite nice. The last couple of days have been beautiful here, but usually where there's cool somewhere, there's heat somewhere else, and it's been a pretty impressive heat wave. Sam, I know for you, it's been, I think you hit 100 there in Denver again today.
Every day.
Yeah, it looks like tomorrow, though, or Friday is cooler with temperatures dropping. It'll only be in the 80s there tomorrow, which is great. You might even have a day close to 70 early next week, which will be really refreshing. But overall, I mean, we've had this really persistent drought in the West over the last several years. And when you have dry soil, that helps to create sort of breeds heat. You don't have soil moisture, so that can have the temperatures rise higher. We had Salt Lake City that reached or it tied their all-time record high of 107. That was last reached in 2002 and then in 1960. So three times they've now hit 107 in Salt Lake. And even Vegas, which is a really hot place, usually the average high this time of year is just shy of 100. They've hit 116 on Wednesday. So it's definitely been an unusual heat wave, and also for its duration. So some people say if it's not the heat, it's the humidity. But in the West, it's just the heat. And 116, even without humidity, is dangerous heat. So definitely, you know, heat kills more than most other weather hazards throughout the year. So it's important to really pay attention to the heat and your fellow neighbors, too, who might be more susceptible to it, and try to be on top of that, because heat really can be a challenge, especially for some vulnerable populations.
And Dan,
like you said,
I was going to say, and Dan, I don't know if you know this or not, because, you know, this is pretty early in the summer season yet. I mean, it's not even officially summer yet, right?
Yeah, Jamie. I mean, I guess from a meteorological standpoint, we say June 1st is the beginning of meteorological summer, but from an astronomical standpoint, that starts in a couple of days here. But for record keeping, it's easier to say June, July, and August is meteorological summer. But yes, you are right. It's early. Most of the record high temperatures, like all time records, or the hottest time of year in a lot of these places, or most of the country, is sometime in July. So we're about a month early. It can happen this time of year, but this is pretty unusual, and it's just a pattern that's set up. And the drought out in the West doesn't help things.
Well, it's funny we should mention that because that goes in tandem with wildfires, and that's a little bit of what we're going to talk about tonight. So that's a good segue to bring in our guest, Ellen Kirchman, a member of PSWA for a very long time. She's a psychologist, has written a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction, and she'll tell us about those. But the first one I became familiar with was I Love a Firefighter. And it was really kind of aimed at families to help them understand the life of a firefighter when they're on duty and some of their challenges and how they can best support them and give them a healthy, supportive home environment. Well, she has now revised that book and actually added some data on wildland fires because of what's been going on in California the last few years. And that actually came out yesterday. So welcome, Ellen. Anything else you want to tell us about yourself?
Well, hi. Glad to be here. I'm out in the Bay Area in California, and I got to tell you, it's hot as blazes here, probably in the 90s. Most unusual for us, and of course, we are all feeling like we're sitting on a tinderbox because of the drought. Things are just totally, totally dry here. I wish we could get some of that rain from the East Coast. So I'm delighted to be here talking to you, Sam, and to Dan, and all of your guests as well. Let's see, what can I say? I've been working with public safety first responders for about 40 years. My first book was called I Love a Cop, What Police Families Need to Know. And people always ask me, am I married to a cop? I am not. Never had a date with a cop. Wouldn't even think about it because that was my profession and you don't want to mix that stuff up. It can get you in trouble. So, after September 11th, my publisher asked me would I write a book for firefighters for obvious reasons, the great sacrifices that and loss of life that happened in September 11th. So then I wrote the I Love a Firefighter, What the Family Needs to Know, and I do love a firefighter. My late brother was a volunteer firefighter for about 16 years, and my book, the first and the current book, were dedicated to him. And I learned a lot of things from him about what it means to be a firefighter. And the book, I hope, is useful both for urban career firefighters as well as volunteers because, as you know, the greatest majority of firefighters in the United States, particularly covering rural areas, are volunteer firefighters.
Well, in fact, Jamie has been one, so this is a conversation he can get something out of. And in way of disclaimer, I actually did date a cop once, just saying. Actually, it was a sheriff's deputy. So.
Okay.
But, you know, one of the things we can do with you that we've had a lot of CISM-related guests. Becky's making a comment that they live in an area served by rural and volunteer firefighters. Jamie, that's really predominant on the East Coast, isn't it?
Oh yeah, if you're not near any of the metro centers, pretty much most of the area is served by volunteer firefighters outside of the Philadelphia metro area, the Baltimore metro area, the Washington DC metro area. All the rest of the counties are all served in all fully or in part by volunteer firefighters and often ambulance crews as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes perfect sense. So kind of what we want to look at here, and this is a big question, but so you deal with firefighters, I'm sure EMS in there as well, and police officers. So I kind of want to look at what are the things that are the same and what are the things that are different. You know, being away from home, which is more of a firefighter thing because I work 24-hour shifts. There's different stressors, don't you think?
Yes, there are. There's lots that overlap and that would overlap from most all first responders because I also see dispatchers. We tend to forget that they're there. So there's lots that's similar, and then there is a lot that is different. So let me see if I can break this down for you. You mentioned one of the big ones, of course, that firefighters are often gone for 24 hours at a time, or if they are deployed to a forest fire, or wildland fire, they can be gone for months at a time, particularly those who specialize in the wildland firefighting. And so that leaves their families on their own for a really long time. Police officers tend to work by themselves, or maybe they ride double in a cruiser in some places, but often they're on their own. And firefighters live and work in groups. So that requires a certain amount of interpersonal relationships because they live with each other. That's a great support. And depending upon where you are and whether you feel like you're happy with your assignment, it can also be somewhat of a stressor. I think that the people, now this is just my personal opinion. There's nothing, no science here to back up what I'm about to say. But I think really that people who are attracted to police work are a bit different from people who are attracted to the fire service. I think people who are attracted to the fire service come from an attitude that they really they're helping. They want to help, and they're also really quite physical people. Often they've been athletes in their lives, and they are really mechanical in the way they think about things because they love their machinery. They love their engines of fixing things. Police officers help people in a very different way. I think both these groups want to make a difference in the world, and that's what attracts them in some ways to the profession. But police officers help people in many ways, but very often their job is all about control, controlling bad guys, controlling crowds, controlling themselves because they have a lot of stressors on the street. If they're street cops and they cannot respond in a natural human way, for example, if somebody assaults them or spits on them or calls them names, and neither can firefighters, but I think that cops face that more, perhaps, because there's another difference. Firefighters are real heroes in our culture, and people in our culture have very mixed and ambivalent feelings towards law enforcement. They want it when they want it. They don't want them when they don't want them. And in that tension between wanting them and not wanting them is particularly stressful for police officers. And as you are well aware, we've just gone through a long period, a continuing period of social unrest since the George Floyd event. We've gone through, there's been lots and lots of, as you know, anti-police protests, which really affects police morale. It's affecting recruitment, it's affecting retention. And ultimately, to many officers, the sense that because they're wearing a uniform, people automatically think that they are racist is a terrible burden on them and on their families with lots and lots of different consequences from that. And it really feels like a betrayal. And we know anytime betrayal is involved, that really sets people up for post-traumatic stress as well.
Oh, it certainly does. And that's exactly what I was going to ask you about. Are fewer people wanting to be cops these days? And the other question I have on that is, yeah, there's going to be a few bad ones. You know, no profession has 100% good people. And we've certainly seen the ones that haven't made good choices because they've been highlighted everywhere all the time. But, of course, people don't understand. There's a bunch of good ones still out there. But they're being treated badly, too. What do you do with that?
What do you do with that? What do I advise police officers and their families to do with
it? Yeah. How do you bring that up a little bit and give them some encouragement? And you know, we know you're not a bad guy, but we can't help what people out there think because of a few that didn't make the right decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not that easy these days. I would tell people don't read the newspapers, don't read blogs, stay off social media, stay away from, because there's just all kinds of stuff that's floating around and can be exaggerated and can be falsehoods and so forth. I would tell officers and their families to make a real concerted, conscious effort to put more positive stuff in their lives. I mean, police work, even in other times that aren't quite so contentious as we find them today, police work, a lot of it is great, is negative. And so I would say make a conscious effort to take care of yourselves and your families, to do things that are positive, to remember why it was you got into policing in the first place, into a focus. And if you're going to be on social media, look for the fact, the community support that is out there, because it is very common that officers, law enforcement officers, underestimate how much support is actually out there in the community.
Well, that's good to know.
I want to add another thing, Sam, that I don't think I said earlier. Police work, I think we would assume is a lot more stressful than firefighting. But as I was researching this second edition of I Love a Firefighter, I really came to the conclusion that we really don't know the answer to that. There may be some sort of common sense observations that there's a lot more obvious stress because of the media coverage for cops, the cell phone cameras, the fact that people often are non-compliant or trying to kill them, and that there's all these been huge demonstrations, which are quite, can be dangerous. But the fact is that we haven't studied firefighters very often or very much. There's not as much data. There's plenty of data nowadays about stress in law enforcement, but there is only beginning to take a look at the stress of being a firefighter, particularly being a wildland firefighter.
Oh, my God, yeah. Well, it happens. Sometimes I'll tell you about the great cookie caper in the East Bay. That's a whole big harangue about them getting cookies and how some people reacted to that. Like, they should be out fighting fire, not eating cookies. But, you know, they need to eat, too. Becky, you have any questions or thoughts for Ellen?
Sorry, I had to find the unmute button there. Sort of an off-the-wall one. I have no idea if this is actually something that can be answered, but I'm curious if the weather has an impact on morale. Like, I'm thinking days like today in Colorado where it's just ungodly hot and humid, or when there's, you know, a major storm, how does that impact, you know, the psychological nature or the mental health of you know, firefighters, police, first responders?
Well, I would assume that, you know, working the midnight shift in the pouring rain or trying to put out a fire when it's freezing cold and your hoses are freezing up adds to the stress of the job. And I wouldn't be surprised if people go, why am I doing this now? Why aren't I sitting in front of a computer making, you know, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year. So I would think so. And then, of course, you know, we see with, for example, Katrina or flooding or the wildfires here, when the first responders have to go to work and leave their families, they're often helping people while their own homes are being destroyed, flooded, burned. And they don't know where their families are, or they can't, you know, they can't be in contact, or there's no cell phone coverage. I think that that is really difficult, and it's very taxing and frightening, and yet people, the first responders, will continue to do their jobs while having all of this anxiety about their own families and their families' welfare.
Absolutely. Jamie, you got to have some thoughts. You've been there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember one of my first disaster response scenarios was when a hurricane came up the East Coast and was hitting the Maryland and Central Atlantic area. Gosh, it's been probably over 20 years ago. And we had to, you know, and I was at the firehouse, and there was, you know, 80 mile an hour winds coming through our area. And my family and two young children, my wife and two young children, were at home, you know, a couple miles away. And power was out. Phones were down. This is before everybody had cell phones. And so, yeah, it was not something, wasn't easy to kind of be sitting there while, you know, on call while this was going on at the house.
I can well imagine. Dan, what are you thinking?
Yeah, sorry. I had to find the unmute button. Apparently, it's hard this evening.
You guys need to take a class in unmute.
Yeah, apparently. No, it takes, I don't know. It's just it takes a couple taps on the phone here. I think the whole idea, you know, the whole idea of this first responder mental health and how they deal with these types of situations is really interesting. We've talked on this podcast before about the challenges in meteorology about it, and seeing different things when you're, you know, surveying a tornado damage and things like that. And I was actually interested to hear if Becky had any questions on, I know she's read the book on is it Arizona or New Mexico who had there was a movie that was done after. It was a pretty famous incident, unfortunately, of a really challenging event out there. And I can't remember the exact incident, but I thought I'd be interested to see if we had any discussion on that.
You're talking about the Yarnell fire?
Yes, where there was, yes, that one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
I can't recall the name of the book offhand, but it's a tough, tough book to read. And I haven't seen the movie and probably can't. but it was just one of those really, really quick moving fires that overtook an entire mountain. Hotshots, I think they're called.
There's a mountain in the name. But it took over a bunch
Granite Mountain hotshots.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and killed 18 of them, 17 or 18, maybe more. I'm sorry, I can't remember the details right now. But that's just one of those things that, you know, when you're, I don't know how anybody who knew those people ever really recovers from that. I mean, obviously you probably don't. But how do other, you know, nearby, you know, firefighting agencies deal with that kind of just significant loss?
You don't, but on the other hand, firefighting is a choice. Police work is a choice. You kind of know what you're getting into. Your families may not always be crazy about it, but I think in some ways, if they're going to go out, they want to do it doing what they love. That's just kind of my first thought on it.
Different, Sam.
Okay.
I think people, you think you know what you're getting into. It's a little bit like having children. You think you know what that's going to be like until you actually have children. and then it feels quite different. So that the a massive loss of life, like the one that Becky was describing, is really hard to absorb. And because first responders are essentially helpers, I think that there's an awful lot of guilt, survivor guilt, that comes up after an event like that. The idea that, you know, why me? Why did I survive? And my colleagues did not. My fellow firefighters didn't. I volunteer at the First Responder Support Network out here in California, and we, after the major fires we've had in the last couple of years, and one that almost took out our retreat facility, I mean, we heard a lot about fear, that people had never seen fire behavior like this in their lives. They were so fast moving. We heard about people being afraid in a way they had never been afraid before. The exhaustion, the emotional and physical exhaustion from having one fire after another with no ability to recuperate. And I give an example in my book of one of those where the fire service had just been at a mass shooting and then they hardly had any time to recover from that, maybe a day or two, and they were deployed to a really nasty wildland fire. So there's often no time to recover. We hear terrible stories about listening to other firefighters dying in those shelters that they have, and it must be just horrible. I mean, and you know these people. You are so bonded together.
Yeah.
It's not like it's a stranger. That would be hard enough. But these are, you are friends, and they, you have depended on each other for such a long time. It just magnifies and amplifies the kind of grief that would be there ordinarily because they're so identified with each other and with the work.
Well, you don't even have to know them. I know working in the ambulance world, if we lost a firefighter and a cop or someone from the ER. I mean, it's all kind of one big family. And whether you personally knew them or not, you're going to take a hit with that. Jamie, you had a question.
Well, just something that came to me as Ellen was discussing, you know, the fact that these people were facing fear in a way that they hadn't really encountered it before. And I think that, you know, to do this kind of a job that has risk associated with a high reward is a certain amount of suspension of belief that something could happen to you so that you can go do your job and go take those risks. Because if you really thought about what could happen, you wouldn't ever do the things you do sometimes. And I think some of these events and situations that have been happening have caused people to come face to face with something they had refused to admit to themselves. Do you find that to be the case, Ellen?
Absolutely. That's a terrific point. I call it adaptive denial. Firefighters and cops and first responders of all stripes have unrealistic beliefs they have a set of beliefs that enable them to do the job. And those beliefs are, I can help, things will be better because I got there, people are better off because I do my work, I won't stress out, I can handle stress, I can handle catastrophe, all sorts of beliefs about oneself. Because you wouldn't get out of bed or do this job if you didn't have that set of beliefs. But when the big one hits, as they say, that can simply crash somebody's belief system. And then what happens are the kinds of things we work with people up at this at the First Responders Retreat is we have to show them that some of those beliefs were necessary but unrealistic. You can't change physics. You can't change the law of gravity. And because what happens for first responders is when they get hit like this with this unrealistic belief, instead of saying, gee, my belief was wrong, or I was asking too much of myself that I should always, whatever the fill in the blank there, they turned it on themselves. And there's a lot of shame and self-blame that is really causes a great deal of suffering.
Well, I remember, you know, as an ambulance company supervisor long ago, before CISM was a thing, we had a line of duty death, and I happened to be involved in getting that person to the hospital. And the reactions of people were really interesting to me. And I think I came to the conclusion that there was, especially with the younger ones, there was the sense of invulnerability that, well, I'm the good guy. I'm out there helping people, so nothing bad can happen to me. And then, you know, this happened, and I think it was a real head slap for a lot of people.
Go ahead. Well, that's why when we do this kind of stress inoculation training in the academy, it's too early.
Yeah, you're right.
There's no Velcro. The officers or the firefighters don't have the experience, the road work, as it were. So they are in that state of denial. It's like trying to do marital counseling with people who are desperately in love with each other. They don't want to hear it. They don't have the experience that any of it makes sense. So they say, oh, I'm different. It won't happen to me until it does. And then we have to say to people, look, didn't make any difference that you didn't turn right instead of left, that you could have been there a minute earlier or a minute later. The person was probably dead before they hit the ground, or there was nothing you could have done to stop this or prevent it. Or, you know, you were on vacation when your buddy got killed or burned up in a fire. It's not your fault that you, because that those people who weren't there when they think they should have been also do a great deal of have a great deal of suffering. We have to say that a competent first responder sometimes makes things turn out right, not always. And just to sort of change that mindset, give people some breathing space so that they're not always having to be perfect, because that's impossible. Nobody's perfect. And that myth of perfection really is harmful to first responders.
Oh, so true. And you don't go through a career, especially a long career, without running into some of those really terrible, awful incidents. We got to wind down, but I'm going to get some final thoughts from the team here, and then I want you to talk just a bit about your books. And I think we need to have you back for a conversation really focused on families and what families can do to be helpful. Ms. Becky, any thoughts from you?
You know, I've kind of just been trying to take it all in. I think this has been a lot of
a lot of good information. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation on the next podcast, because I'm definitely interested in what, you know, the family support can look like.
Definitely, and that all of this translates to, and of course, if Kyle were here, he'd say, oh, what about dispatchers? Because you're right, Ellen, we do forget about them sometimes. And certainly disaster workers. They're the same people that are putting themselves in an even tougher situation. Dan, any final thoughts?
No, I think things have been spoken too well so far, and I would agree with Becky's comments.
Jamie, what are your thoughts? And we'll wrap it up here.
I think these are important discussions, and I do look forward to getting back with Ellen to talk about family support, and that door swings both ways, the responder's support for their family and the family's support for the responder. It these two things go very much hand in hand.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we close here, Ellen, tell us a bit about, we talked about your nonfiction books, but you got a fiction series you're working on and a couple organizations you work with that you wanted to mention.
Okay. I just want to thank Jamie, because that's exactly, when I talk about families, that definitely, that door swings in both directions. It is not just what the family can do to support the first responder. It's how first responders can make things way too difficult for their family. So I'd be happy to come back and talk about that. All right, let me talk fast here. So you know I have the firefighter book, the cop book, and an additional book called Counseling Cops, What Clinicians Need to Know, which is also good for chaplains and peer supporters, because we find that less people who might, you know, it's hard enough for cops to reach out to get help for any first responder. And so if they get somebody that doesn't understand what you all do or the culture that you work in, therapists can make some really egregious mistakes. So I wrote that book.
Amen.
Pardon me?
I said amen to that.
Okay. So this is a book that will help, I hope. And I wrote it with Joel Fay and Mark Kamina, both of whom are psychologists, founders of the First Responder Support Network, and former cops themselves. So that really added some depth to it. At some point in all of this writing, I got tired of reality and decided it must be easier to make this stuff up. In fact, as a writer, it is not easier to make this stuff up, because when you write fiction, you know, we all want to be swept away. So it's like a different craft, writing fiction and nonfiction. But I have a series called the Dot Meyerhoff series. Dot, that's named after my mother and my maternal grandmother. And Dot is a police psychologist. And so I tried to tackle some important issues in the book. The first one delves into police suicide. The second one delves into what it's like for a cop who accidentally, unintentionally shoots and kills somebody, an unarmed teenager. The third one has to do with the stresses of working in an ICAC unit, Internet Crimes Against Children. And the fourth one, which nobody has quite seen yet, takes a bit of a leap off about and goes into talking about dealing with someone who is in prison. So those books are not yet available. I'm making a big shift in my writing life here, and they will be available as ebooks. If you go to my website, sign up for my newsletter, please, and you will you'll find out when they'll be available. And there's also a lot of other, I hope, good information in my newsletters.
So how much of you is in those books?
Everybody asks me that. Dot is younger than I am, and she takes more chances than I ever did. For example, assault with a deadly weapon, impersonating a public official, breaking and entering. I would have lost my license if I had done any of that. She's pretty spunky, but like me, she never gives up. And I never give up on people either. So I had all of these books, these four fiction books, are based on, not based on, they're inspired by actual officers, actual events, actual things I've been involved in. But of course, told in such a way no one could ever trace them back to the real people. But I get a lot of inspiration from the work that I've been doing and the people that I've met. First responders are a remarkable bunch of folks.
Exactly, as my books reflect a lot of people I worked with. So Jamie's got this down as far as, unplugging from reality. He writes fiction, not just fiction, but fantasy and science fiction. So that's the world he jumps into, right, Jamie?
Got to have an escape. So I get away in the corners of my mind where all the imagination comes from. So that's my way out.
What are some of your books, the names of some of your books, Jamie? I'll look them up.
Well, my first series is an urban fantasy series called Extreme Medical Services, about paramedics who treat supernatural creatures. So it's
I love it. I've read them all.
But anyway, yeah, this has been a great topic, Ellen. Thank you so much for coming on the show and chatting with us tonight. And we definitely will have you back to talk about families and dealing with stress, because I think that's something that we just don't talk enough about. And there is a support network there if we know how to take care of it. So.
Great. Well, I'd be more than happy to come back. And if any of your listeners, family members, or first responders are needing some extra help, please go to frsn.org. That's firstrespondersupportnetwork.org. We're a volunteer organization, and we hold retreats for first responders with the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And then we hold what we call significant others and spouses retreats for family members.
Beautiful. I love it. Jamie can link to that as well as. Do you have a website?
FRSN, yes, does have a website, frsn.org.
Well, what about your website for your books?
Oh, yeah. The ellenkirschman.com.
Okay. I'm stepping on your show ending there, Jamie.
That's all good stuff. We got to have that information out there. So anyway, we want to also thank, since Joe's not here, I'll just kind of jump in and remind folks that the show is sponsored and brought to you through the generous support of the Paragon Medical Education Group that provides innovative and effective disaster response training of all sorts. So if you're looking for something that can really change the way your jurisdiction gets some high experiential training into their responders, you want to go ahead and get in touch with them. You can find them at paragonmedicalgroup.com, also on Twitter at paragonmededu, and on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group. So please check them out and reach out to them. They provide customizable resources. So whatever your budget is, they can probably put something really useful together for you. Anyway, I want to just thank everybody for coming on the show. Dan, where can folks find you if they want to follow what you're talking about on the weather side of things?
They can find me on Twitter at WXDepot, D-E-P-O, so without the T. And thanks again, Ellen, for being here. Good to hear your perspective on this. Really interesting.
Thank you.
And Becky, where can folks find out what you're up to in your new venture dealing with emergency preparedness and response?
Yeah, folks can find me on Twitter at WX_Bex, over on LinkedIn. That's where I'm sharing some of the work-related content. So Becky DePodwin. Actually, I think it's Rebecca DePodwin now. And then always the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
And Sam, how about you?
In those same social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and I mentioned to Ellen about our vastly growing international audience and our Facebook group. So drop into Disaster Podcast. It's the only one on Facebook. Maybe we can coerce Ellen into coming over there and joining us if people have questions. And certainly
I already joined this morning.
Very good. And certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website. Jamie?
Well, folks can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations. So please look me up, friend, or follow me there. And, of course, go to disasterpodcast.com, and you can find links to subscribe to the show on your favorite mobile device, Android, iOS, or even by email if you want. There are links right there below the audio player at the top of each episode page. So check those out. Good episode, Sam. I'm really excited the way you've connected with the members of the public safety Writers Association and the amazing resources that they have in their membership. So thanks for doing that.
Sure. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of them out there with a lot of great experience in different areas that we haven't talked about. But as far as this topic, which will be continued, be safe. Nobody's superhuman. And if you need help, get it. And I love the link that Ellen gave us. That's a good place to start.